National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Thanksgiving is all about gratitude for what we have received, but it also begins a season focused on giving as we prepare to celebrate the ultimate gift of the child Jesus. On Register Radio this week, we discuss giving with I Give Catholic Executive Director Corey Howitt. And then Father Carter Griffin tells us all about his gift of self through his vocation story. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. The Tuesday after Thanksgiving weekend has become known as Giving Tuesday. It's a day to rally with online financial contributions to your favorite charity. This Giving Tuesday, which is December 3rd, 39 dioceses and approximately 3,700 Catholic parishes, schools, and ministries across the United States are participating in what is called I Give Catholic. The Register first started following I Give Catholic 5 years ago, and we're amazed by the growth. Joining us to talk about I Give Catholic's success is Corey Howitt, who is president of I Give Catholic and the executive director of the Catholic Community Foundation in the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Welcome back to Register Radio, Corey.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Corey, I mean, as I said in the intro, we've been following this. The Register's been following this for 5 years. For me, it's just an amazing amount of growth in those 5 years. I mean, 39 dioceses who are participating in this. Wow. Congratulations.
No, it is. Thank you very much. It's been fun, and y'all have been great and not only journeying with us as we grow, but being able to tell our story, because it is such a neat deal to be able to be a part of myself, but also to see something in our faith such have such a deep and great impact across our country. It's been not only exciting, but really a gift of the Holy Spirit to watch it grow.
Absolutely impactful. You know, I mean, I Give Catholic is all about making sure that these ministries have what they need to succeed. So, you know, financially, what they need to succeed. Ministries need money, right? They need money to actually succeed.
And that's been such a fun part of watching this growth, is that we really feel that we've touched upon not only a need, but filling a void inside of the church. You know, oftentimes we, as we know, in the church is the largest charity in the world. We do all these wonderful, great things, but a lot of times we don't tell our story enough. And in an opportunity like this allows you to be able to tell the story. But in the best part is that the fundraising is not just asking for money, but inviting people to join that mission. And so what we have is a day that we're able to invite others to join the mission, so that they don't just feel that they're giving money towards something, but part of being the true community impact. And so this day is really kind of given such a voice to that and an avenue for that to kind of come alive.
So for those who have not actually participated in I Give Catholic or have heard about it before, I mean, we've covered it, but some people may be listening and haven't heard about it. What actually happens on that day? What will these 39 dioceses and 3,700 ministries be doing that day and even this weekend to help prepare for this day?
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing is to really go back. Giving days have become a little bit more popular in the country in the past 5 to 10 years. What has happened is a giving day is basically a 24-hour day, 24 hours in one day to be able to kind of rally support for you to be able to kind of get together, build community, kind of do it as putting a little bit of fun into the fundraising and being able to come together so that you can raise funds for those days, for that day, for those different ministries. But what we've been able to do is to be able to say, hey, why don't we do this so that we celebrate all the many Catholic ministries that are out there. And so what we've been able to put together is a platform that you could go to, igivecatholic.org, and basically you could go there to find the many ministries that have had spiritual impact in your life. And so what we've done is started with our archdiocese, but notice that many dioceses want to be a part of it. And what they do is they have a page that they go to and that they share on social media with their many followers, and invite them to be able to join that. And so they give online through this portal, But what it does is it's not just a fancy giving page. It's a community builder because you do it amongst other parishes, kind of as a friendly competition. Mm-hmm. But also you'd see the collective impact. So on a giving day, you have a ticker that shows the full amount of the day raised. And just like last year, we raised $5.6 million across the country in that 24-hour period.
It's amazing, Corey. I mean, it's just such an amazing way to generate excitement around giving. I know this year, Peter Jesserer Smith, our staff reporter, wrote about this a couple weeks ago, just kind of in advance, and he talked to Nicholls State University, who is participating in the I Give Catholic campaign on Giving Tuesday. Tell us about their success last year. What was their purpose for raising money?
Sure. So it, like many ministries, you sometimes wonder, man, should we do this? Do we have this vision for, you know, Father down there, Father Mitch Seymour had a vision for an adoration chapel. And he wanted to be able to do it, and he wasn't quite sure how to be able to reach all the people that were involved in his ministry, knowing that people had cycled through Nicholls State in the past and or felt their faith was important. And so he basically took his vision and kind of created his I Give Catholic page around that vision to be able to build an adoration chapel. And he says, I want to be able to not only offer that for our students, but I want to invite others to be a part of it. And so he put that page out there and kind of put some renderings and just did some really fun things around it. He did a lot of videos inviting people and made really it a community-wide kind of appeal. And it was amazing how many people gravitated to that, not only in his community, but others nationwide that saw what he was doing and wanted to be a part of it. And he raised all that money that day for his chapel. And so he turns around and That's says, awesome. Man, I would have never thought in a million years we would have been able to raise the money for the chapel. And it's not that it magically happens. He put a lot of effort into it, but he used the platform as a way to be able to have the community feel ownership into building this adoration chapel. And it was beautiful.
You know, Corey, at this time of this time in the church, we need encouragement. You know, one of the reasons I'm talking to Father Carter Griffin in the next half of the show is because we need to hear the good news stories. And you're exactly right that this opportunity gives us the chance for communities to tell their good news. Do you expect that the giving will be hurt by what's going on in the church, that people won't give as much?
You know, I really don't. You know, it's interesting. I think part of this, and as y'all address that, really trust is the key here. Because when you're able to show direct impact to a donor and somebody that's interested in a mission, you're able to say, hey, this is what we envision with it, like Father Mitch did down there. And then, by the way, we're starting building the week after, and we're going to, and here's the completed process, that they didn't just drop them off right after they gave them money. They kept in touch with them, showed the progress of the building. And I think it's that kind of direct impact that kind of very much rebuilds the trust. And so, if you will, it's kind of the opposite of the distrust that has happened with, right, you know, what's going on in the church right now. It's a way to be able to rebuild them by treating the donor not necessarily as an ATM, but somebody that's really joining in that ministry. And I think that's the greatest connection we could ever ask in the church, is the feel of the community and feeling that you're trusted, transparent, and being a part of something.
Absolutely. So, Corey, you and I are both here in Louisiana and in the New Orleans Archdiocese. I'm at Our Lady of the Lake Parish, and I did see the I Give Catholic sign that at our parish and school this week. Where are some other places that are participating outside of our lovely state of Louisiana?
Sure. So the fun part is inside of the beautiful website that we built out for this day, and invite all the listeners to go there, is www.igivecatholic.org. And we have this really neat map that's interactive that you could go and click on the many dioceses. This is diocesan driven. So what happens is the parishes, schools, and ministries under a diocese participates, but we like to try to rally and give kind of support as a community, structured intentionally this way, to the diocese. So we have, you know, dioceses out in California, we have Oregon, Montana, Idaho, up in the top of Michigan, to the Midwest. And so it's really fun to be able to see, you know, all these different dioceses, from mission dioceses all the way to dioceses like Atlanta, who's, you know, just really kind of taken a hold of this and said, hey, we want to be a part of it, all the way down to certain national ministries that have a presence. This year, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City is participating. And so it's so fun to be able to see these ministries say, hey, I want to be able to tell my story, but I want to do it in a unified way so that I'm a part of the universal church. And I think that that's been part of the appeal to this. You could participate in your parish in Louisiana, and the very same small parish in rural Montana is participating, and all counts to the greater impact that we raise on that day.
Excellent. Well, Corey, thank you so much for bringing this to us. We will continue to follow the success, and of course, I personally will participate. So thanks for joining us.
There you go. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
When I come back, I hear a vocation story. A convert to Catholicism and a former Navy SEAL gives all to Jesus and his church. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
There's nothing like EWTN's National Catholic Register. Revealing, engaging, inspiring. The most comprehensive news of the day from a Catholic perspective, with the moral authority that comes from being faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And in the words of our founder, Monsignor Matthew Smith, a paper that will always be loyal to the Church and has no selfish axe to grind. Because the truth when the Register was founded in 1927 is still the truth today. The award-winning National Catholic Register helps readers engage the culture with confidence in the saving and sanctifying gospel of Jesus Christ. Get 6 free issues today by ordering online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. That's 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. There's nothing like a good vocation story to encourage the spirit, and this year, the church needs encouragement. Father Carter Griffin's story does not disappoint. Father Griffin is rector of St. John Paul II Seminary in Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of Princeton University, a former naval officer, and author of a new book, Why Celibacy? He joins me now. Father Griffin, it's so good to have you back on Register Radio.
Thanks so much, Jeanette. It's good to be here.
So I have you on this time. I mean, you've written for the Register. We've talked about celibacy. We've talked about the gift of celibacy. You've written a couple of pieces on that very topic. You've recently written the new book, Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest. And it just occurred to me that our listeners on Register Radio may not have heard your own story of the priesthood. Because, first of all, you did not come up in the tradition, the Catholic tradition. You were Presbyterian. And so you had to... Was that right?
Yeah, Presbyterian. Yeah,
right. So you had to convert to Catholicism, and then you had to take this even one step further and become a celibate priest in that it was just completely unfamiliar to you in your childhood, really, or at least your religious upbringing. So, how did you convert to Catholicism?
It was a funny story, actually. When I was talking to the priest, and I'll get to that question in a second. When I was talking to the priest who was instructing me in the faith, he at one point said, you know, I hope one day that maybe you'll join me at the altar. And I wasn't even Catholic, mind you, let alone, you know, I had no desire whatsoever for the priesthood. I had no desire for celibacy. I had, you know, and he saw something or wanted to plant a seed or the Holy Spirit moved him or whatever. And that was kind of a real sort of turning moment for me. But of course, that was already when I was in the process. And, you know, I think the kind of the remote preparation, if you will, the kind of the what goes back is that I actually grew up in a lot of Catholic countries. My dad was in business abroad, and a lot of the countries he lived in was in Latin America. And so I was around Catholics, and I have to say that I had a pretty positive view of them. I mean, they were the friends who tended to take their religion more seriously in my own background. And I remember when I was 5 years old, I was at a Catholic school, actually, in Brazil, São Paulo, Brazil. And I remember the kids going up to receive communion and being told by being told by the teachers that I couldn't go up and receive. So maybe it was childhood trauma that led me to become a Catholic. I don't know, but I remember there was a nun who was teaching the Hail Mary in class, and Sister Maria, and I remember raising my hand. She was an American nun from Boston, actually, but wonderful lady. Anyway, so I raised my hand and I said, "Sister, I don't think I'm supposed to be saying this because I'm Presbyterian." And she's like, yeah, Hail Mary.
That's funny.
I knew the Hail Mary early on. So when I was in college, I was dating, well, not really dating, but sort of interested in a girl who I knew was a faithful Catholic, and she took me to Mass. And it was a kind of life-changing moment for me when I was moved by, I didn't even know what I was seeing and what I was experiencing there, but I remember on the long drive back, I was going to school in New Jersey, and when I was driving back, I just sort of realized that I needed to ask someone about this. And so I knew my next-door neighbor at college was a faithful Catholic, and mm-hmm. he took me to Mass. So as is so often the case, so he took me to his parish priest, and I came in through the RCIA process. But what I was going to say is that what is so often the case is, the intellectual side is so important. This priest gave me wonderful books to read, and I sort of read my way into the faith to an extent, but the beginning was the faithful witness of a faithful Catholic, in
yes.
this case, Catholics. You know, and that, I think, is the takeaway. And when I listen to the vocation stories of the young men that I serve in seminary work, it almost always, I'm always listening for that hook. You know, who's the person? You know,
right.
Was it the grandmother? Was it the friend at school? Was it the, you know, whatever it might have been?
Well,
and that was certainly the case for me.
There's so much to unpack in what you just said. I mean, for me, first of all, I'm the mother of a 5-year-old child and a 3-year-old and of course a 1-year-old too. But the 5-year-old, you know, is his first year in a Catholic school, or actually it's his second. He went last year too. But you know, he's seeing the faith. He came home the other day and said, "Mama, I want to pray the Rosary." And the reason was they were practicing all week to pray the Rosary. For a living rosary they were doing with the whole school, and he brought that to me, and he said, I want to do this. And I have my 3-year-old who asked me, I want to receive Jesus in the bread, he told me a couple weeks ago. So, you know, just that presence of children in Mass, we don't realize how often that speaks. So, what you just said just gives me this hope for what I do week in and week out to usher my kids to a Catholic school and to Mass. But also that, you know, this neighbor who was just a practicing Catholic, that just his routine and his way of life was witness enough. I mean, we need hope, and this story is one that I think brings hope.
You know, I think that's so true. It's something about that, you know, God wants to work through us to bring his good news to others, and he's not looking for, you know, great mystics and miracles. He's looking for kind of fidelity, and he's looking for simplicity, and he's looking for people to just kind of do what they're supposed to do as Catholics and live as they're supposed to live, and we will attract people to the faith. There's something compelling in the faith itself that we can sometimes forget. And you're right about your children. I mean, I remember a theology professor, actually a great theologian, and he said, never forget that children can be mystics, you know, mm-hmm. and that sense that children can somehow touch the supernatural in a way that we have forgotten. You know, and I think that's part of when Jesus says we should become childlike. I think he sort of means, in addition to their humility and all those other things that we always focus on, means that somehow they are able to kind of breathe in the supernatural atmosphere more easily than us lumbering adults, you know? And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, it was certainly true in my case, yeah.
Absolutely. They teach me so much. So that was the first part. So you mm-hmm. became Catholic. How did you then take the next step of becoming a priest?
Well, so, as I said, that priest sort of planted the seed, and it was there. I had briefly flirted with the idea of becoming a Protestant minister. I hesitate to say that because that suggests that I was actually a much better Protestant than I was. I was not particularly, that observant. But I guess I believed enough. I was kind of the kid in the family who was like, "So, are we going to church today?" kind of thing. You know, I think I had wonderful parents. I was blessed with such a great family, both of whom have become Catholic since my conversion.
Oh, really?
And just wonderful. Yeah. And, but you know, we were pretty observant, but anyway, I was kind of always interested in religion. And so when I became Catholic, I guess I just figured, well, I need to at least give the priesthood a chance since I had given the ministry, you know, being a minister. And, I asked about it, and they said, well, you really couldn't enter the seminary anyway because, you know, you just became a Catholic. And so I was relieved by that. And I had already been planning to become a naval officer, which I continued to do. So I entered officer candidate school after college and became a naval officer. And during that time, I was still dating. I had another very serious girlfriend. I was really kind of not close to the priesthood, but it just kept coming back, you know. And I made one last-ditch effort to run, which was I applied to law school, got into a great law school, and I got into the seminary at the same time. I was applying to the seminary. And so I remember standing in front of a post office box with both letters, deciding which one I was going to put in, whether I was going to go to law school or the seminary. And yeah, I mean, I think it was just kind of the witness of meeting good priests and just this kind of the hound of heaven sort of thing. You know, I couldn't get it out of my mind, and the beauty of being able to serve people in this way. And I think a conviction that I wanted to do something that had kind of eternal consequences, you know, with my life. I wanted to do something that really helped people in that way. And, you know, the priesthood allows one to do that. It's not the only way, but it certainly is a particularly powerful way of doing that and making a difference in the world in the places where it really counts. So I think all that kind of came together, and then eventually I put that envelope into the mailbox, and here I am.
Absolutely. I'm hanging on your words. I guess I'm thirsty, you know, for this kind of hope. But one of the words you said is eternal consequences. And, you know, we're at a time in life and in our society that we don't think about eternal consequences very often. And so what a beautiful way to describe the work of the priest, who really is helping everyone, all of us, to look to the eternal consequence of our lives. You don't hear that very often, Father.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that when I was doing this, the work for the book that I did at Why Celibacy, was looking at spiritual fatherhood and how that is lived out not just by the priest, but also by the natural father and natural mother, living out that spiritual motherhood. And I think that kind of giving our children that sort of supernatural outlook, giving and just helping our brothers and sisters in the faith. You know, a lot of people are really struggling right now with all kinds of things, you know, things going on personally in their families, in the community, in the nation, in the world, in the church, you know, and having that kind of supernatural outlook, I think, is a great gift. It's a great act of charity to others to be able to help them kind of lift their eyes a little bit and not going to get wrapped up in the crisis of the moment. And being able to say, no, Jesus is still, I mean, he's been there from the beginning through crazy times in the church, and he's not going to leave her now, you know, and like that conviction that we're in good hands, even when things seem to be getting more difficult.
Absolutely, and that's attractive. Let's turn to the seminary. You are rector at St. John Paul II Seminary in Washington, D.C. How many seminarians do you have now?
Well, in this college seminary, we have 50 seminarians, which is probably like a mid-size seminary. There are a few that are bigger. There are a lot that are smaller, actually. It's very kind of one-on-one kind of work, especially in college seminary. So you don't want the place to get too big. But we're full, and we've been full since we opened. We opened, not that long ago, in 2011. We're only in our ninth year right now. And we started with 20, and then we added an addition and filled that up and added another addition. And so there was a real sort of pent-up demand, I think, for college seminaries. There are a lot of young men, young guys who are coming forward and discerning the priesthood. It's obviously, you're going to have a higher attrition rate at a place like this, and so maybe only about 40%, 50% of the guys who enter as freshmen will end up, 50 to 60% will end up going into theology. But that's good. I mean, that's kind of part of the deal, is you come in here and you give God a chance, you know, if this is what you're called to do.
Sure.
So it's been a great joy and a source of a lot of hope and joy for me as well.
So what do you see? I mean, the seminaries have been under fire, if you will, for this last year because of all of the scandal that we've seen in the church, and that the seminaries were places of scandal in some years past. And even some seminaries, even today, have had to do investigations. That's a strain, I would say, to put it very lightly, I guess, on seminarians. How are your men?
I have to say, I'm edified and humbled by the faith that they have lived out, especially here in Washington, D.C., kind of the epicenter of a lot of this. But these guys recognize that they're not just following, you know, kind of a man or a leader. I mean, they're following the Lord Jesus and the priesthood, and he's the high priest. Obviously, Jesus instituted a church with authorities and the apostles and their successors, and they respect that, and they respect I think the healthy authority of, but also a sense that they're not really doing it for that reason. They're doing it because they think the Lord is calling them to it, and so I think that's their attitude. I remember I was in a seminary in 2002 during the last kind of wave of crises,
yes.
And I remember first of all just being motivated myself to like I'm if I thought about leaving before, I'm not leaving now. You know, like this is. Now I really want to be a priest, you know, and hopefully be a good and holy one. And I think these guys are experiencing that same thing. So I think there's a lot of, you know, but I also think that there needs to be a kind of a growing awareness among many of our people, and you were kind enough to publish something that Monsignor Andrew Baker and I wrote this past summer to help people understand that there have been a great number of changes in seminaries, and especially motivated by the image, by the example, but also by the writings of St. John Paul II. And those have been going on for nearly 30 years now. It's not universal, it's not perfect, but it is a far cry from when the vast majority of these guys who have committed sexual abuse over the last 70 years were ordained. You know, there's an enormous bell curve of when these guys were ordained who've done so many of these crimes in the last 70 years, and it's very few in recent times. And I think a lot of that can be attributed to cultural changes and a lot of other things, but also to the very disciplined and intentional approach of St. John Paul II to reform the seminaries. So we're all the beneficiaries of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Father Griffin, I'm so appreciative of the work that you do informing these men, and thank you for sharing your story. I think it's an inspiration to many people. Not only people like me who are raising three boys, but to maybe young men who are considering the priesthood, and just to see your fatherhood of these seminarians is a real witness. I invite our listeners to read your book, Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest. You can get it at EWTN's Religious Catalog. You can find it at the website, www.ewtnrc.com. And of course, you can follow Father Griffin at the Register's website, ncregister.com. And we sure do hope, Father Griffin, you'll join us again here on Register Radio.
Thank you. I'd enjoy that. And thanks for all the great work you're doing at the Register.
For more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining me on Register Radio here on EWTN. For our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.